Coming up, author Mark Griffin joins Ileana in just a minute.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies.
And now, it's the I Blame Dennis Hopper podcast, starring Ileana Douglas. Eavesdrop with Ileana as she interviews Hollywood's most prominent players about filmmaking, acting, and what really happens on the set of your favorite flicks and TV show.
Hi, it's Ileana Douglas with the I Blame Dennis Hopper podcast. Excuse me, my dentist is calling. Sorry, Mary Jo. And I'm here with my lovely co-host, Tamara Berg.
Hi, everybody.
It's a very loose Thursday.
We haven't done a podcast in a little while.
Who knows
what's going to happen.
It's come to this. I'm actually working.
You're working so much that we can barely fit one in. I love it. Are you having a good time?
I'm having an amazing time on the show. I can just say that I'm working on Goliath and I'm having an amazing time, and it's but that's all I can say.
How's the craft services over there? That's really a very important question.
Everything is great. I mean, it's you know, I usually stay in my trailer. I'm doing some writing in my trailer
too.
Yeah. So I do bring my own snacks.
Of course you do.
I am officially like my mother.
Oh my gosh.
The other day I was in the grocery store.
Yes.
And I started joking around with the cashier, and I had that horrifying moment. I was like, oh no, I am officially like my mother. Aww. Because, you know, your whole life you're horrified.
Yes.
When your parents are joking around with the cashier.
Yes.
Like, there's just nothing more embarrassing.
Yes.
Than that. And I was doing it. And I didn't stop at one corny joke.
No,
I think
you didn't. Oh, look at you.
I think I went for two or three. All right.
We have a lot
to talk about. It's National Book Day today.
Yes.
And ironically, what we're going to talk about is the closing. I can't believe I'm saying this, of the Samuel French on Sunset Boulevard.
It is absolutely an institution.
Yeah. And what's even worse is it's not even getting a great send off, because a couple days ago, I don't even know this, somebody robbed it. Somebody.
They got to get the good stuff before they close or something?
I have no idea.
That's
but
ridiculous.
Somebody vandalized the place, and now it's boarded up. So this,
when are they scheduled to close? Because the
I'm
other thing is,
sure.
is that I heard there were people rallying around trying
yes,
to maybe save it.
I'm going to be there Saturday at 2.
Oh, nice.
I'll be running from my dance class to there.
Hair in a ponytail.
And yes, and a leotard.
Mm-hmm.
And Francis Fisher is going to be there.
Note, people, you're going to get to see Ileana live and in person in a leotard if you go to Samuel French on Saturday
right.
afternoon.
On Sunset Boulevard.
On Sunset.
And sadly, of course, the backdrop is that it's all plywood. I was thinking, what can we do? Maybe I'll bring my book, read from my book, or
yeah.
read from any book. I was saying to Mark Griffin outside that his book is the type of book that would flown off the shelves at Samuel French, because not only was it, you know, a great place to get plays, but it was an incredible movie bookstore in which everything was lovingly kind of, you know, edited.
Curated.
Yeah, curated. Mm-hmm. You'd walk in. They had beautiful cards and all sorts of really nice Christmas things.
Mm.
The aesthetic of the store was wonderful.
Yeah.
The way they had everything arranged. But when you walked in, there was like this beautiful wall of things, that books that were topical, obviously biographies. You know, if Robert Wagner had just written his book, it was there.
Mm.
Alec Baldwin written, it was there. You know, and it just is beautiful. And I'm more sad about this. I was very sad when the Sheet Music store also closed.
I loved that store.
Hollywood Sheet Music, which is now a manicure pedicure place. And I just don't understand
yeah.
it. You know, it's just really sad. These things seem to happen in a blink of an eye, and you don't have any warning, and then they're gone, and then it's a Chipotle or it's a mm-hmm. Starbucks mm-hmm. or something like that. But
well, you know, I come from the Bay Area, and City Lights Books in San Francisco,
mm-hmm.
incredible institution in a similar way. That Samuel French was. And I believe they've saved that store from closing. So maybe have a little bit of hope. I know you're a reckless cynic, but
yeah. Well, because again, this seems to be so typical of Los Angeles that has lost the Hotel Ambassador.
Yes.
Which was where Kennedy was killed. Robert, I mean, Kennedy, the place should have been a museum.
Yes.
And where countless films, I've shot countless films at the Ambassador.
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, it was an incredible place, and
yes,
boom, it's knocked down. The
yes.
Garden of Allah, which, of course, I never saw, that was torn
yes.
down. Chasen's became Bristol Farms.
Yes. Oh,
the Brown
Derby.
That was
a really sad one.
The Hamburger Chasen's. Hamlet, you know.
Yeah.
And I don't know. It just it makes me particularly sad because Los Angeles is the movie capital of the world, and they seem to be the most guilty of just destroying the culture of artists.
And the history of film.
Yeah. And you get to the point where you believe that, you know, that are they doing it on purpose? I mean, do we really need another
Chipotle?
Yeah. Well, that's what it's going to be. I mean, the Blockbuster down the street. I mean, I understand nobody makes movies anymore, but every time I go by what used to be the Blockbuster, and it's now a bank, and there's a bank across the street, you know, it's, you know, these banks go up and these Starbucks go up and these, you know, fast food places go up. And I mean, again, I don't know. I mean, if you want to run a manicure pedicure shop, you get a, it's like there's one on every corner, but to not have a beautiful bookstore like Samuel French that has been in that location, and mark my words, because I live very near this area is desolate. It is not, it's really sad. Meltdown, which was across the street. I mean, that's why I'm spending a lot of time with this. They took away Meltdown.
What was Meltdown?
Meltdown was an incredible, it was like a comic book store. They sold graphic novels.
Right.
In the back. The Nerdist did the podcast in the back.
Oh, no kidding.
Again, just an incredible artistic hub where you'd see comedians. You could go in there, you could hang out, you could get coffee and see other people and feel that, you know, there was some hope in your life. And you know, that I was very sad that that went away. And now Samuel French, and it's going to hurt the Pikey, too, which is the little bar next door. But that is it. We're killing, you know, we're killing artists in our society. And that's the way it is. And building walls.
Oh, my God.
There's Meltdown.
Don't get me started.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Meltdown was amazing. And anytime I was lonely, I could walk in and people could recognize me from Ghost World.
No. Well, it's always a good thing.
I'm kidding. Look at how cool that place was. That's what you want on Sunset Boulevard.
Yes.
That's what tourists come to see.
Yes.
They don't come to see a Chipotle.
I totally agree with you.
I'm very, very upset by this.
And you should be.
I hope people come out tomorrow. Listen, not
Saturday.
Much as... Sorry, not tomorrow. Saturday. Apologies. I'm old. And just see us. We'll hang out and we'll cry together.
Yeah.
But anyway, in the meantime...
Let's bring in Mark, shall we?
Let's talk about Mark Griffin.
Yeah.
This is... I hosted the other night, along with Larry Edmonds' bookstore... at the TCL Theater, who they're becoming fantastic in doing interviews with Piper Laurie and Mark Griffin. He's the author of the this great book on Ruck Hudson. His first book, which I discovered the other night, is about Vincent Minnelli, which I can't wait to read that. 100 or More Hidden Things, Life and Films of Vincent Minnelli. And this one is, of course, All That Heaven Allows, about Ruck Hudson. I can't wait to read it. I was already skimming it. Please welcome Mark Griffin.
Thank you so much, Ileana.
Where's your... You don't have your sparkly tux from the last time.
Swarovski crystals on the lapel. Yeah. I left that back in Palm Springs.
Oh, where? Wait, next to Liberace's house.
Palm Springs, or is it actually in a garment bag out there?
That was the plain black shirt in case this didn't read well.
Oh, okay.
I try to come prepared.
You clearly do.
Now, I'm so excited. First of all, you're here on National Book Day.
Yeah, oh. I didn't know that.
Yes.
That's
now,
exciting.
Aside from your two books, which we're plugging, do you have any favorite movie books? You know, I the other day I put a book up, my very first movie book that was a gift. It was the Arlene Croce book about Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, my grandfather gave me when I was a kid. But did you have favorite movie books that you perused?
This may shock you, but all of my favorite books when I was a youngster were about Judy Garland. Oh. So I had a collection of about 20 Judy bios and would read them incessantly. Yeah.
This is completely off topic, but if I were on a desert island, I always say, like, for music, I'd go with Judy live at Carnegie Hall.
Can't get any better than that.
It really can't.
It's still in print. It's never been out of print since 1961.
Really?
Think about that. Yeah.
I am. I mean, every time when you a few months go by and then you hear Judy Garland, you just go, yeah, she was
phenomenal.
Just an amazing talent. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're going to get your books, but our fun game on the show is we always ask people, do you remember the first movie that you saw and who took you to see it?
I do. It was Napoleon and Samantha, 1972. And my older sister, Joanne, and one of her high school friends took me. They were very well-meaning. Uh-huh. And it was a Disney film with little Jodie Foster, little Johnny Whitaker, and they were saving a circus lion who was past his prime.
Ooh,
and they ran away with the lion. And I was completely traumatized, not only by the film and the lion, but also they took me up into the balcony thinking that that was going to be a great adventure for a 4 or 5 year old boy.
Yeah.
And it was the opposite. I was left sobbing hysterically. And so it's interesting that, you know, for someone who later became a movie obsessive,
yeah,
that the first experience was so neurotic and horrible.
That's a good one to look at. But now, did you have any aspirations before you started writing movie books? Like, did you do little film reviews in school, or were you that kind of a movie kid?
I was very precocious, almost like a mini Noel Coward. I would sit at my parents got me a baby Smith Corona typewriter, mm-hmm. and I would sit there virtually all day cranking out little novellas and short stories and scripts. And then a couple of years later, they got me a Bell and Howell movie camera. Mm-hmm. And so the poor kids in the neighborhood would be, you know, forced to appear in all of my little home movie productions. And I did do a 3-hour version of The Wizard of Oz with all the kids from school.
Oh, and wow.
Yeah, I always prided myself on my version was more faithful to L. Frank Baum's text than the MGM version.
Of course it was.
Yeah.
What is it? I'm always fascinated, but what is it that drives, what kind of crazy ego drives people? I think when I was in third grade, I forced people, we didn't have a movie camera, but we reenacted the Pearl. One of my friends actually was the Pearl. Like, she was a pillow. I put pillows around her. And there, a photograph luckily exists of this. But it's so funny how you're like, no. And now I must take my film to the masses, which is the school auditorium.
Right. Know. And this is in the hinterlands of Lewiston, Maine. So,
yes, which I was surprised. So you're from Maine.
Mm-hmm. If you can believe it, southern Maine.
You think of Maine as so rural, but mm-hmm. Were you getting first run films there to look at?
I mean, to this day, if you go to the Cineplex, it's like Kung Fu Panda on 6 screens. So we would get a movie probably, if we were lucky, like a year and a half after its original theatrical run.
It's like us.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I made the best of it because our local public TV station would air, like, they had a Warner Brothers package from the 40s, so I got to see all of the Betty Davis and Bogey movies, and I would tape record them. This was before the advent of the VCR.
Oh, my God. We are the same person.
Yeah.
I did the same thing. Yes.
And then the next day, you would relive the experience, memorize the dialogue, and then force your neighborhood friends to act out Dark Victory. And, you know, of course, I get to be Betty with the brain tumor. And, you know.
I like that you did Dark Victory. Well, I'd always, of course, do movies that my grandfather was in. That was my thing. And Nutschka. I had a GE tape recorder, which was to this day my favorite present that I have ever received, with a little microphone. And
that was a great gift.
Oh my God, I love that. So, did you discover? Were you a fan of Rock Hudson's before you decided to write about him?
I would say that I had a healthy respect, and over time that continued to grow. Because mm-hmm. when I was younger, a lot of his films, unless you got lucky, weren't really readily available on TV, even on The Late Show. Some of them were. Mm-hmm. But as I got older, I started to watch a lot of these performances, and particularly as he grew and matured, I said, wow, he's really interesting, and there's more mm-hmm. to him than just the beautiful heartthrob.
Yes.
And one of the goals, if you will, with All That Heaven Allows, was to sort of reclaim him as an American film icon. Mm-hmm. Because when the AFI did that list about a decade ago where they listed the 100 greatest film stars, Rock wasn't even on it, which I found kind of inconceivable.
Yeah.
So I said, you know, this is somebody that was in films directed by Douglas Sirk and George mm-hmm. Stevens, and he's appearing opposite Doris Day and Elizabeth Taylor, number one film star for nearly a decade,
yeah,
based on exhibitor polls. And I thought, well, what has happened to his legacy? Why are we sort of forgetting about how important Rock Hudson was?
And why are we? Because, again, when we were talking the other night, what I found so fascinating about him is the phases of his career, the different, you know, there's the Douglas Sirk period, which now seems more important. Like when I was growing up, it was the Doris Day films that were, imprinted in me.
Right.
And yeah, why is it that people just don't think of him when he's so iconic?
Right, and he's sort of right in front of our face in a sense, right?
Yeah.
Over 60 feature films, so he's very much there. But I think after Rock's death in 1985 from AIDS, I think the public perception was that and then also that was followed by very high profile Mark Christian trial. Mm-hmm. There were some tell all books that came out in the mid 80s, and I think all of these things combined sort of tarnished his reputation, if you will, and
right.
he was no longer here to defend himself.
Yeah.
And, you know, more than 30 years have now passed since he died. And I said, this is a good time to reevaluate and reassess and mm-hmm. take a really comprehensive and careful look at not only the life, but the films and the whole show business career, and really give this man his due.
Mm-hmm. You know? One of the things we talked about, too, that was very surprising to learn was he had kind of a terrible childhood.
It's almost something out of Charles Dickens, isn't it? It's
yeah.
really kind of sad and bleak. He grew up in Winnetka, Illinois, which is about 20 minutes outside of Chicago. And during the height of the Depression, 1931, Rock's biological father sadly abandoned the family, both Rock and his mother. This was when Hudson was about 5 years old. And, you know, the mother had to sort of really scrounge to find work and support herself and her young son. And then a few years later, she had the misfortune of marrying this very ill-tempered, volatile, alcoholic former Marine who did adopt Rock, but also would abuse him and the mother, physically mm-hmm. abuse him and the mother as well. So very sad. And it's interesting that throughout the whole life, when you really map it out, this is someone who's beleaguered. They're facing dramatic circumstances at virtually every turn.
Mm-hmm.
You know, closeted sexuality, blackmail attempts, extortion attempts, maybe a marriage that seems, by our contemporary perspective,
I know, we have to get to the crazy marriage, yeah.
Right. But what's interesting to me is that Rock never lost sight of his goal, which was to become a screen actor.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is, you know, he always maintained this sense of goodwill. And
that's what I saw, too. In every interview, he seemed sort of unflappable. And even when they were talking about his dire childhood,
mm-hmm.
he just, everybody describes him, you know, Piper Laurie was saying, oh, he's such a joker and so sweet. And that sweetness really, you know, shines through.
Yeah, I think some of these unfortunate circumstances would have really derailed, a person who was not as strong as Rock.
Mm-hmm.
But it's astounding to me that he sailed through all of this and with sense of humor intact, as you say, and also just maintained this sort of dignity about him. You
yeah.
know?
The other thing, of course, that it's always shocking, when you're thinking about it in the present day, is that his, and we're always talking about casting couch things, but his agent, manager, Henry Wilson, who discovered him, was he literally a truck? Was that true? Or was he trying to get into show business? Or was he just a truck driver? And Henry Wilson said, you're so good looking,
Right.
You need to be an actor.
When he first relocated to the West Coast, this was in the late 1940s, he was a truck driver. He was driving around like frozen apricots and distributing things like that to supermarkets.
Kind of a movie.
Yeah. And he had never sort of communicated this secret goal or ambition to become an actor. Mm-hmm. And so many people, you know, he was obviously turning heads constantly, not only because of, you know, how stunningly handsome he was, but also his height, 6'4". Mm-hmm. So he's sort of an Adonis who's a truck driver. And yes, so eventually he does meet Henry Wilson, who becomes this very much like a cross between Harvey Weinstein and Henry Higgins. So on the one hand, you have this very manipulative and predatory, manager of one of the busiest all-male casting coaches in Hollywood.
It's unbelievable.
Yes.
And spoiler alert, we're going to get to this. Your book has been optioned, and they're going to make a movie. I hope they're going to... Oh, my God. Who gets to play Henry?
Henry Wilson.
What a great part.
Virtually guaranteed a Best Supporting Actor Oscar nomination, right?
Because it's fascinating. Because what's fascinating about it is the acceptance of Rock Hudson and Tab Hunter and Rory Calhoun and all these people that just, they just accepted it.
Mm-hmm.
That if you were going to be in show business. Now, is that because it would have been harder to have a straight manager to deal with, do you think?
I'm not sure.
I wonder if Henry, you know, positions it in a way like, listen, I understand you and I understand your needs and I understand what we're going to need to do PR-wise to cover things up.
Exactly. And on the other hand, if you take a look at how vulnerable some of these young men were, like Rock, you know, very handsome, but had no formal acting training whatsoever and was sort of fresh off the bus from Winnetka, if you will. Guy Madison had been a sailor. Rory Calhoun had been an ex-con. So he's got the raw material to work with. But if you positioned it in, I can only imagine that Henry Wilson may have said to them, I am your ticket to the big time.
Yeah.
And they may have, you know, that may have been true in a sense. Would anyone else have looked at these guys or made a serious, legitimate attempt to get them into films?
Yes. Yeah, so it is. It's kind of a Jekyll and Hyde thing. That's why it's so fascinating, because obviously Rock Hudson flourished. And again, I don't know if this is true or not, but it's at some point it's intimated that Tab Hunter's career and Rory Calhoun's career suffered when Confidential Magazine was going to, you know, publish something. So I was wondering if you could talk about that.
Sure. So as legend has it, Confidential Magazine, which was sort of the big scandal sheet of the 50s, which no one would admit to reading, but everyone did because the circulation numbers were in the millions in the 50s. They were threatening to expose Rock, as they had done with some other stars like Van Johnson. And Henry Wilson reportedly got wind of this and negotiated some sort of a deal. And depending on who you listen to, the story that I tend to believe is that Rory Calhoun and Tab Hunter were the two that were thrown under the bus to save Rock's career.
Mm-hmm.
As in the late 50s, he was the number one star in the world. So Henry Wilson didn't want to lose that golden goose, obviously.
Yeah.
So suddenly you see these two expose stories, you know, Rory Calhoun, for the grace of God, still a convict. And then Tab Hunter was exposed for having attended an all-male pajama party, I think is how it was expressed.
Yeah.
And the reason I tend to believe that version of the story is Hunter had dismissed Wilson as his agent about 6 months prior to the article.
Mm-hmm.
So if you piece all of that together, it seems the most logical version of that.
Okay, let's get into the Douglas Sirk. Well, actually, before that, what the movie that he did with Raoul Walsh, I'm sort of curious about.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, was he, his early, that's the other thing that I think is surprising about him. For me growing up, you know, I discovered him through the Doris Day movies and then the Douglas Sirk movies. But then you go, oh, he was in all these little bit parts at Universal. They were putting him in, you know, these little. So I want to talk about like how did he find his footing in those early films?
So I think at Universal, sort of one of the smart things that they did at that studio was really try you out in a succession of bit parts, one-liners, walk-ons, to get a sense of where you might fit best. And I think in Rock's case, they went purely based on his physicality. They put him in a series of cheap adventure movies. So he's playing Arabs, he's playing prize fighters, he's playing thugs. And I don't think that they got a sense early on, well, here's, you know, this guy looks like Prince Charming. He's probably best served in romantic melodramas.
Right.
And instead they put him in these movies like The Golden Blade with Piper Laurie, which is wonderful. They're very entertaining.
Yeah.
But they're, in a sense, very one-dimensional. So you don't get a sense that there is a deeper talent waiting in the wings.
Mm-hmm.
And but the one with Raoul Walsh, his film debut was actually with Warner Brothers, interestingly. And Henry Wilson sold Rock's contract to Raoul Walsh. And there were high hopes that Fighter Squadron was going to be Rock's first showcase.
Yeah.
And he was so tongue-tied and so nervous and so uncomfortable before the cameras that I think they ultimately scrapped the one big scene that he was supposed to be in.
Mm-hmm.
And so now he's just reduced to a few little bits of dialogue. You do see him in the film.
Yeah.
But it's certainly not the breakthrough that they were
hoping because that's
for.
What I, when I saw the role of Walsh, you would have thought that that would have been a good fit in a way. So then he gets in. So then now let's go to the Douglas Sirk movie. So he really gets his kind of his big break. Is to be in the Magnificent Obsession with that lush Technicolor. And this was something, again, that, pardon me for repeating myself, but, you know, Orson Welles always says that, you know, movie stars look better in black and white. However, in my opinion, Rock Hudson actually looks better in color.
Right.
He, that film, I mean, all those films, but the color is just captivating. You know, he's almost like a cartoon. It's like the colors are so, and his voice is so nice. But how does he get the part in Magnificent Obsession?
I think they finally figured out, he was sort of groomed for a couple of years. They knew that that property was waiting in the wings. It was a remake from an earlier version from the 1930s that had made Robert Taylor a great star.
Oh.
So Universal was banking that lightning would strike twice, and they put Rock together with Douglas Sirk on Taza Son of Cochise, which is kind of a little bit of a low budget.
And then the other, For Me and My Gal.
Which we just honored the other night.
Yes.
That's a very entertaining little film.
Yeah, that's a lot of fun with Piper Laurie.
Right. And Magnificent Obsession works so well because finally they hit upon the winning formula that, you know, here is the heartthrob, the matinee idol for a new generation. We're going to pair him romantically with the Oscar-winning Jane Wyman. And, you know, hearts will be aflutter because, you know, he's finally found the right vehicle to, the breakthrough vehicle to present him correctly. And then it was such an enormous success that they reteamed Rock and Jane Wyman in All That Heaven Allows. The studio was inundated with fan mail. Like, you have to put them together in another movie because, everyone was so taken with Magnificent Obsession.
Well, it's just wonderful to see, even though some of the plot is just completely...
Totally implausible.
Completely.
It's like, I think Sirk himself said it's gloriously insane, you know.
Yeah, but it's... my favorite thing, of course, is when he hits her in the car. Sorry, spoiler alert, but I mean, she's incredible in it. I love that you could simply recover your eyesight by going to Switzerland or where does she get her operation?
It's Shadow Mountain is the name of the facility that Jane ends up in. Yes.
I love it.
And Rock is the one who performs the operation.
Of course. He must. And so then All That Heaven Allows, and just another beautiful, lush. And I think this one is almost the one that everybody thinks of because he's appearing in that beautiful plaid shirt.
Looks like he's just stepped out of the pages of a vintage L.L. Bean catalog.
Yes.
Right? And the deer are eating out of his hand. And
it's unbelievable. And he's he probably never saw a wood shop in his life. He's technically, he's supposed to be the younger man in that, although it's not obvious.
Right.
But he is the younger man.
It's a little bit naughty. It's the May-December sort of romance. And also, there's a class scenario because Jane Wyman is this recently widowed woman who's well-to-do, and Rock is her gardener, which back then was sort of taboo, I guess, that you could not date your maintenance man or your and the entire town turns against her. She's practically lynched for
I know.
Yeah.
I know they won't. They will not accept. But it's very daring again because you know it's you don't normally see that's another thing that he's able to pull off is that for a submissive character. He really pulls it off and you're really kind of rooting for him, you know, whereas I would think that sometimes maybe certain lead actors wouldn't want to take a part like that.
Right. Because it does seem sort of secondary to her character in a sense, yeah. But so much pivots around him in the story that, and he got wonderful reviews for it.
Yeah. You know? It's being so sensitive. Do you think that he ever, so now that he's in his stride, is there at all any concern for now that he would be outed, or how does this double life dynamic fit in with him now being a major movie star? He's going out with Vera Ellen or fake dates or what's
right.
happening?
Yeah, this is where the pressure is really on him because even Life magazine did a cover story on Rock in 1955 and the editors threw down the gauntlet in the first sentence of the paragraph. They said something, and I'm paraphrasing here, but Rock Hudson is 29 years old. He's not married, and he needs to explain why not.
Oh.
So this is not even Confidential magazine. He's being baited in the mainstream press.
Right.
And they had, at this time, his publicist, the studio, Henry Wilson, had sort of exhausted all of their efforts to, you know, portray Rock as the ultimate Hollywood bachelor. You know, he was nearing 30, and,
right.
you know, if this is the great matinee idol, why isn't he partnered with one of these women that he's constantly shown escorting to premieres?
Right.
You know? So I think this is when I imagine Henry Wilson sat down with Rock and said, you know, we really need to do something because they're breathing down your neck.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, depending on who you talk to, some people felt that Rock was part of that discussion and other
right.
people wondered if he wasn't. And he was, because he was such a non-confrontational and passive individual,
mm-hmm.
did he just take orders from Henry Wilson? Did he just do whatever his agent decreed?
It sort of seems like it. I mean, again, one of the most upsetting little things about him is this, that she secretly tape recorded him.
Right.
And he sounds just sort of pitiful.
It's very sad, very revealing. Yeah. This, we're talking about Phyllis Gates, the woman he was married to for 3 years. And towards the end of the marriage, she surreptitiously, as you said, tape recorded him through a private detective. And then, we should point out, would have had access to those recordings. So one can only imagine if you have that kind of ammunition at your disposal
right.
in an era when gay equaled death in terms
right.
of a career, what one could have done with that material.
You know, what is shocking to me is, and you mentioned again, how many times he was blackmailed and how this never... To the public, he didn't become an alcoholic. He didn't crash his cars. You know, he always just seemed like this, you know, formidable movie star.
Right. I mean, I can't tell you how many of the co-stars or the screenwriters or directors just said he was the consummate professional, always a gentleman, you know, impeccably well-mannered.
Mm-hmm.
And it's rewarding to hear that, you know, for someone that was having to grapple with, you know, so many different personal challenges.
Yeah.
I really admire the fact that he was able to behave, you know, in such a dignified way.
Yeah. And so what'll be great, I guess, about your book is just, again, imagining him, seeing him in the movies and then think, oh, my God, to be like, secretly record it. You know, it's just terrible. Like some of the things that he had to, that he had to go through. All right. Now let's talk about Giant, another film.
Mm-hmm.
I love Giant. And just how magnificent he was. And did he have any competition with James Dean at all? Did they? There were some. That was the new kid. I mean, they were the polar opposites of movie star and then actor studio
right,
type
right.
of acting.
By all accounts, they did have a rivalry, and I think it was based on a number of things. They mm-hmm. We should mention they had both appeared in Has Anybody Seen My Gal?
That's right.
Jimmy
yes.
Dean has that little cameo.
He's got the little cameo. Thank you. Yes.
And some people tell me their history, their kind of tumultuous history, might date back to that film. Did Rock make an overture to the younger player that was then rebuffed? We don't exactly know if that happened.
Oh, I love that idea.
Conceivable.
That's
And then when they do get on location in Marfa, Texas, for Giant, this great sprawling epic, you know, as you say, Jimmy Dean was kind of the l'enfant terrible of the Actors Studio, and he was coming in. He had already shot East of Eden, but it hadn't been released. Mm-hmm. But already there was this great buzz that this is the next big thing. You know, he's really going to set the screen on fire. And Rock, you know, had just finally found himself in a big prestige film directed by George Stevens. Mm-hmm. So, and he's in the lead. And I'm sure, you know, an actor being an actor, he doesn't want to relinquish that sort of power to a supporting player.
Right.
And I think another part of the rivalry may have been based around Elizabeth Taylor, because mm-hmm. Hudson and Taylor really hit it off when they first met and bonded almost immediately.
Yeah.
And that friendship would endure, as we know, to the end of his life. Mm-hmm. And I think when Jimmy Dean arrived a little bit later, he kind of squired Elizabeth away and would kind of pull her away from Hudson. And one wonders now, I thought about this, could that have been sort of an Actors Studio trick, because he's sort of mirroring the relationship that's going on in the film.
Well, one of the great scenes in the movie is when they have the fist fight after, oh my God, that scene's incredible, after Dean is discovered oil and they have this terrible fist fight.
And he's slathered in molasses, you know, which is filling in, you know, substituting for the oil. Yeah.
But I wonder if it's a little unnerving, because, again, it does feel like they're really, you know, they couldn't wait to take a swing at each other. And Rock Hudson's a big guy.
Big, you know? Strapping hunk, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, in later interviews, Rock, whenever he was constantly asked about James Dean, and he would always say, well, you know, he's a remarkable talent, but as a professional, he did not have any respect for Jimmy, because I guess Dean would constantly keep them waiting in the sweltering heat on location with no apologies. There would be, and, you know, Rock tended to be very consummately professional. Mm-hmm. So I think he may have viewed that as, you know, not acceptable behavior.
Now, and then Giant, he was nominated for, this was his only nomination, right?
Sadly and astoundingly, the sole Oscar nomination in that whole career.
And did they do a campaign? You know, because again, you forget that you always think about James Dean and Giant, but he was nominated, you know, also. And did they do a campaign for him? Because you don't really think of him in that way.
Well, by the time Giant was released, Dean was deceased.
Right.
And they were, if I'm remembering this correctly, I think they were nominated against each other. Oh. So they would have canceled each other out. And then the winner proved to be Yul Brynner in The King and I.
Right. So here's this big, like, his whole career is leading up to Giant. And why didn't it leapfrog to him doing better parts? Because the next time he sort of emerges is Pillow Talk and Doris Day movies. And was that his choice, or what happened there?
Well, he had to beg Universal to be loaned out for Giant, and they made that very difficult for him. He had to renew his contract, and there was a whole negotiation process around that. But it's true, as you say, once Giant was over, you would think that this would be followed up by other big A-list prestige films.
Right.
But Universal sort of quickly returned him to the melodrama formula.
That's too bad.
Yeah.
Because you'd see him, like, just as we're talking, I'm thinking, you know, like, he should have been in The Young Lions or something. I mean, they should have put him in films like that.
Right. He does make an effort. He signed on to do A Farewell to Arms, the remake with Jennifer Jones, and it's a big David O. Selznick production.
Yeah.
Originally, it's going to be directed by John Huston, so Rock had very high hopes for that. And then, unfortunately, Huston left the project, change of director. It was a very troubled production.
Yeah.
And he had turned down several projects. I think Sayonara, possibly, was one that he passed on. So I think that he made efforts to diversify and to do things outside of the Universal comfort zone. Mm-hmm. But I think the studio fought him in a lot of respects.
Now, is he still working with Henry Wilson at this point?
Yes, they are. They stay together until 1966, so it's pretty late.
Yeah, that's a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And so then his next incarnation is the Doris Day movies. And had he ever met Doris Day before that, I wonder?
I think he was aware of her. There's this wonderful story that when he was in the service, when they first shipped out, I think it was, to Samar, he served in the Philippines, mm-hmm. that over the ship's loudspeaker, it was the new hit was playing Sentimental Journey by the young Doris Day, mm-hmm. and all the sailors were crying. I hope that's a true story, because yeah. it just would Aww. Be great to know that it actually played out that way.
Yeah.
But I don't think they knew each other that well, and Rock was initially resistant to pillow talk, because he felt it was so risque.
I know, and it's just so funny.
Yeah. And he was neurotic about the fact that, apart from Has Anybody Seen My Gal, he hadn't had the opportunity to play comedy on film. And I think he was really nervous about that. And
he's so well suited for comedy. I mean, and then again, you think, why didn't he just do, he was so good in this. Why didn't he do, not that you would know this, but the, what is the one with James Garner that you always think Rock Hudson should be in?
Is it The Thrill of It All?
Yes.
I think that's the title. Yeah. yeah.
Why
yeah.
didn't he, like, how did he get that? They were on this great run of doing all these.
Right.
They did Pillow Talk. What did they do after Pillow Talk?
Lover Come Back, which yeah. a lot of diehard rock fans think is actually even superior to Pillow Talk. That uh-huh. would be my opinion. I think it's just wittier, and their rhythms are, they're perfect. They're sublime in Pillow Talk, but I yeah. think they've sort of nailed it once they get to the second one.
Yes.
And then Send Me No Flowers is the third, and all of these films were blockbusters, but the third one doesn't have that sort of cat and mouse chase that we've come to love yeah. about them. And they're already married in that one, and he's a hypochondriac. And it is funny, yeah. but it doesn't have the energy that the other
Pillow Talk is a blast. Just the production design alone is hysterical.
Doris and Jean-Louis gowns, you know.
every outfit, and he just plays it straight, and he's just so funny. I love the scene where he's carrying her,
right,
you know, back to this.
And one of Rock's boyfriends told me that when he first got to know Rock, he said his muscles in his back were aching from having to carry Doris around the lot all day.
Uh-huh.
So interesting.
But they did, so again, they did so well. And so then what does he do, like, in between? Just take time off? Or he doesn't do theater? He doesn't, like, he does theater much, much later.
Mm-hmm. There was a detour into television with Tallulah Bankhead, if you can believe
that's
it.
That's right. He yeah. did that crazy.
The Big Show? I think that's the title of it. The Big Party by Revlon. That's what it is. And it's meant to feel, the viewer is supposed to be feeling.
Go to YouTube right now and put it up, because it is riveting. It's hysterical.
Rock, Tallulah, Esther Williams, Sammy Davis. It's almost like a pop culture.
Yeah. Sammy Davis, as I recall, is like one of the highlights.
Yeah. Yeah. He does a great job.
The door, it's like, you know, a typical night in Hollywood. The door opens and Sammy Davis Jr. comes in and starts singing.
But that, needless to say, that did not last long. It didn't work. I think that was a little too.
It worked for us.
It worked for us, yes. There it is. Yeah, see, the big party.
There it is, the big party.
Your team is quick, Ileana Douglas.
Yay, I yeah. love it.
We love Jeff.
Okay, so we're running out of time, but I want to. Then we have to get to my favorite Rock Hudson movie, which is brilliant, which is Seconds.
Mine too.
Mm. I'm skipping over Written on the Wind. What year was Written on the Wind, by the way?
57, I want to say.
Yeah, I don't know. Which I love Written on the Wind, too, just because it's lurid and fun and, you know.
Gloriously over the top.
Oh, my know. God.
The Mambo of Death, which Dorothy Malone does, you know, in her negligee.
Which, as we were commiserating outside, Dorothy Malone left off of the Oscars.
Glaring oversight.
In yeah. memoriam. Really sad. Anyway, we love her. But so Seconds, how does he get cast in Seconds? John Frankenheimer's now considered masterpiece, but didn't do so well when it came out.
Right. Shockingly. So Rock wanted to diversify. He was sort of tiring of trading on the Pillow Talk formula after yeah. doing a succession of those romantic comedies. And he wanted something really different that was a legitimate acting challenge. Here comes this property that is based on a brilliant novel by David Eli, dark dystopian thriller, which is about swapping out your authentic identity for a more manufactured one. So bingo, that's sort of semi-autobiographical, if you will.
Yeah.
And originally the casting was Kirk Douglas, then they veered off into Laurence Olivier until Paramount said, well, we need a bigger bankable star. And this is where Rock Hudson came into it. And initially, this is sort of a before and after characterization where the same actor was going to play both the before and the after. Right. Rock is the one who suggested, well, I think it would be more interesting if two different actors played the before and after.
Yeah.
And I think he had that was a really smart choice.
Brilliant.
Yeah. And if you haven't seen, of all the Rock Hudson films, if you have not seen Seconds, it's the most surprising, it's the most dramatically compelling, and I think it's the rawest and truest performance in a sense.
There's one scene that it's very disturbing, and I think I heard through the whatever, maybe some of the voiceover commentary, that he in order to do the drunken orgy scene, that was the one that he was the most afraid of.
Right, and I think about most leading men in the late 1960s, it would, in a sense, be very, very risky to do this project at all. But then to say, we need you to hop into a vat of grapes naked and stomp around, I mean, if that doesn't get you to see Seconds, nothing will. But he was really a good sport about that. And
he did very quickly. You could tell, but he was drunk. He had to get drunk. He had to get really, really drunk.
Right. Frankenheimer employed a lot of directorial tricks, like getting him smashed to be in that party sequence where the big revelation comes, or strapping him down to a gurney at the end and not letting them release him. So,
Yeah,
Rock really suffered for his art in that one, I would say.
And the tragedy was that it premiered at Cannes, and you just can't figure it out because it's so brilliant. And when it first came out at Cannes, people just hated it.
Yeah, the screenwriter John Lewis Carlino told me, he said, we thought we would have something that the French intelligentsia would go crazy over, that they would eat it up. And he said when it initially premiered, booed. And then when they realized Rock was in the audience, this thunderous ovation came forward. And some of the critics of the time got it and others didn't. But now, of course, it's revered as a great cult film, which it should be.
Yeah, it's really a masterpiece. And it really is. God, he's just brilliant in it. I can't tell you how much I love it. So, again, we don't have too much time left. But I just want to talk a little bit about, again, some of the way this image sort of was tarnished of being of dying of AIDS in 1985. But again, the significance of that, of the legacy that, although it's tragic, that it really put AIDS and Elizabeth Taylor, helping on the map. And do you talk about that in the book?
I do. I mean, Randy Schultz, who wrote that beautiful book and the band played on, said, which is about the AIDS epidemic, said there was AIDS before Rock Hudson and there was AIDS after. Mm-hmm. And his celebrity did so much to draw attention to the disease. He was really the most high-profile celebrity that had been diagnosed or died of AIDS at that time, at least. And I think it was this notion that Rock had always been the boy next door, and millions of moviegoers had seen him grow up in front of their eyes. And so this is not, it's not the sort of fuzzy, nebulous, maybe intravenous drug users or Haitians who are dying. This is Rock Hudson, major Hollywood icon.
Right.
And so suddenly everyone all over the world knew someone who had AIDS. And I think that really brought the pandemic home to people. It's a sad commentary on our culture that it took that, but I think Rock inadvertently, if you will, played a major role in how, finally administrative funding came through to fight HIV. And
I know you can't, it's still crazy for me because I remember, being in school, remember the big dynasty
with Linda Evans, yes.
That he kissed Linda Evans, and it was like, that was like the drama.
So much hysteria surrounding that.
Did you interview Linda Evans?
We corresponded, and I was glad that she took the position that Rock was sort of doing his best to protect her. It was the most chaste kiss you can possibly imagine, on the side of her mouth. So he was aware that he had been diagnosed.
Yeah.
And, people said to her, aren't you mad at him? Aren't you angry that he put you at jeopardy like that? And she said, no, he did everything he possibly could to be protective.
Yeah. And also he was it's very strange that Ronald Reagan was the president at the time, because having worked with Jane Wyman, and again, they weren't doing anything to help.
No, not at all. And then, as we mentioned, Rock's great friend, Elizabeth Taylor, was really galvanized after she saw not only Rock, but the death of two of her assistants who were gay men. And she said something needs to be done. And she really marshaled the forces on that one. You know, I think she behaved admirably.
So before we go, just talking a little bit about the book, well, two things. Who were some of the most fun people you got to talk to for the book?
Well, our dear friend Piper Laurie was angelic, as you can imagine, and she's just a lovely person. Carol Burnett was a thorough delight.
Oh,
very warm and down to earth.
Yeah.
And they were great friends.
Yeah.
And they were in a stage production of I Do in the 70s, which was very successful. And, you know, William Reynolds, who not a lot of people know, movie buffs will know him as Jane Wyman's son in All That Heaven Allows.
But oh, yeah.
He was terrific. And I asked him about, you know, what's interesting about projects like this is sometimes the satellite people that you get to interview are often as fascinating as your subject.
Yes.
Or they're just, they have wonderful anecdotes and nobody takes the time to interview them. Except Ileana Douglas.
No, I completely. I want every story that was ever told, and I mentioned before that it's an option for a movie.
Mm-hmm.
Congrats! I'm so excited. Do you have any input as to who's going to be Rock? Any wish list?
See, my theory is, Ileana, that they should do the Scarlett O'Hara thing and cast someone that is sort of established but not very well known. It would just be interesting.
Well, like Rami Malek.
There you go.
Look at how well that worked out.
Perfect example.
Mm. I like.
We have a great director, Greg Berlanti, and so interesting that all the auteurs are of Italian ancestry.
Uh-huh.
Fellini, Visconti, Scorsese, Minnelli, Berlanti.
That's interesting. Mm. Well, you know, Marty was such a huge Minnelli fan, obsessed with him and Red and.
Everyone should be obsessed with Vincent Minnelli.
I know. He was he was just a great tastemaker. And are you working on any new books? Or
I have
what's your new, or if you can say?
I have an intriguing idea. I've never done a novel.
Mm-hmm.
And I came across this fascinating story. It's, you know, an unsolved murder case here in Hollywood from the 40s, which does have a celebrity connection. And I found it astonishing that no one had zeroed in on it. So I think I would like to attempt. It would be very much in the Raymond Chandler mode.
Yeah. There's quite a few mysterious
to say the least. Yeah.
Some of them involving Wallace Beery and things like that. People, you know.
Right.
I can't believe they never did like the Eddie Mannix story or anything like that.
Probably too dangerous.
I know, all sorts of surly things. Well, anyway, Mark, thank you so much for being here. I want everybody to get this book. It's terrific, All That Heaven Allows. Spring reading here on National Book Day.
Exactly.
And thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Ileana.
You can look for Mark on Twitter at Movies with Mark on Instagram at mgriffin71368. And his website is markgriffinauthor.com. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
And you can buy Ileana's book, too.
That's
right. I've Dennis Hopper. She's working on the After Dark version, so you should probably read this before that one comes out. Also, like our page on Facebook, and the website for the show is ileanaspodcast.com.
That's right. We're here today live. This was so exciting. Thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure.
As we always say, life is like a movie with a beginning, a middle, and an end. And today's the end of our movie. So thanks for joining us. Have a great day. Bye.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of AfterBuzz TV or its owners or principals.